Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Welcome, Mark Pop here again. Chuck and Julie have decided to take the day off, and they deserve it more than anybody. So I'm going to be filling in today. Hopefully I'll do a pretty good job. I think this is the last time I'm scheduled to do it this summer. I think they need to take more time off and let me do it more often, but that's okay. So we're going to do two segments. At first, I'm going to talk about something that's pretty kind of bothering me right now. And then in the second segment, I'm going to bring on John St. Augustine, who I've had on in the past. He is an expert in police procedures. And we're going to talk about what happened up in Aurora, Colorado on July 23rd. Normally, we like to talk about cases because we're both very big into homicide investigations and different types of investigations. This Aurora thing has us so shook that we just want to have a conversation about that to explain to people kind of this whole video, because you should be looking at that video and going, okay, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me as well. So we're going to talk about that in the second segment. You're going to see me looking off here because I like to use the background to be able to put things up on the screen. And this is something, well, that didn't work. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I'm going to learn something new every time I do something. Technology, it's always a great thing. So this is something that's very important to me. This is kind of like Cop 101, if you want to call it that. Whenever you go into law enforcement, there's, you know, these things that they teach every cop. And the thing that they teach you is about the judicial system and how it works. And this is basically how it works. We refer to this as kind of the triangle of the judicial system. And of course, you have three branches, if you want to call it that, of the judicial system, this triangle. I always put law enforcement at the top because I was a cop. So that was kind of the most important to me. If I worked in the court system, maybe I'd put the courts at the top. But this is basically how our judicial system has worked throughout history from pretty much the beginning. And this is one of the things that makes our republic so great, is our judicial system and the fairness that we have in the judicial system. Now, there's always exceptions to the rule. I'm sure if Chuck was here, we'd have a nice little debate about how sometimes the judicial system is not fair. I would agree with him. And one of those things that I really have an issue with is the, grand juries. Grand juries really bother me because, you know, you've heard that old phrase that you can indict a ham sandwich with a grand jury. And that is definitely true. And we've seen it in some cases. But really how the judicial system works is the foundation of our Constitution, our republic, and how the system works. Now, we have the government, but then we have the judicial system. So law enforcement, the role is to keep people safe, to keep the community. I hate to use the word citizens, but it's to keep, you know, protect and serve. I mean, that, just like you see in a lot of the police cars that you see on TV, that really is the job, is to get to the truth, to come on scene when somebody calls law enforcement and says, hey, I need help. I need you to come help me. And if there's been a crime committed, law enforcement's role is to investigate that crime. And then if they can determine who committed that crime, to arrest the person or charge the person based on probable cause. And then they turn it over to the court system. Now, in that transition, like you can see in the pyramid where it goes from law enforcement to the court system, you're going to book the guy into jail if it's a felony, if it's a misdemeanor, maybe not, depending on whether it's domestic violence or whatever. But basically, an individual waiting to go through the court system after he's been arrested or served and released from law enforcement, he's going to either be out on bail or he's going to be sitting in a jail. And this is where you get two different terms. You have inmates and you have prisoners. Prisoners are someone who have been convicted of a crime and have gone to prison. An inmate is someone who typically has not been convicted of a crime yet and are sitting in jail waiting to be tried. So after law enforcement does their job, then they hand it off to the court system. And then the court system, using a district attorney's office, they will present the case to a judge with a jury at a trial, and then they will determine the outcome of that case. Now, we know that the majority of cases never make it to trial, but that's still part of the court system. So a DA will show this case to the judge. The judge will actually do some things like a preliminary hearing and some other things to make sure that there is probable cause before they bring anyone to a trial. So then after the court system is done, if they determine that someone needs to serve time in prison, they hand off to the correction branch of the law enforcement or of the judicial system. Then they'll serve their time in prison, which is a punishment. I mean, that's the reason we have it. But also, not just to punish the individuals because they've committed a crime to the point where they feel that he or she needs to spend time in prison, but it's also to keep us safe. That's why you have a bail system as well, is that if these individuals are a threat to the community or a flight risk, you leave them in jail so we can be safe. That's really what this whole system is about, that law-abiding citizens will be safe and secure in their lives. That's how the judicial system works. What we find is that if you want to change the foundation of our government, and we talk about the government and then the judicial system, but if you want to fundamentally change our society, our country, it needs to be broken. And if it's not broken, then nobody wants to fix it. Now, just a few years ago, you would have gotten a great deal of Democrats that would have agreed and publicly supported law enforcement and the whole judicial system. They can't do that now, because you have a few individuals who have taken the whole Democratic Party hostage. And if they say anything to support law enforcement or not the agenda that they're trying to preach or to sell, they're a racist. And they're actually kind of going after some of their own. So a few moderate Democrats that have been outspoken, they've actually kind of attacked them and stuff. But again, the moderates are too afraid to be outspoken and support law enforcement because they're afraid of the repercussions of that. And one of the things that I've definitely learned being in law enforcement, it's hard to go to prison. It is not an easy thing to do. A lot of people think, well, man, it must be really easy to go to prison. It's not. You have to go out of your way. You got to really try hard a few times to go to prison. If you commit a burglary, and even I even hate to say this, even a sex assault, or sex assault on a child, a lot of these crimes, the first time they get probation. And so you've got to work hard to actually get a sentence into prison. And there's all kind of plea bargains and stuff that go on. And the goal is so they don't go to prison. So understand that, again, it's tough to go to prison. It's not that easy. You got to work at it to really go to prison. So the system works, but it's fragile. It's a fragile system between this pyramid or this triangle on how the whole system works. And if one system overloads, if you want to call it that, like let's say law enforcement decides to have all of these, they're going to go into an area and they're going to have more patrols. They're going to get more law enforcement. They're going to hire more cops, and they're going to make sure that our areas are all safer. So they do this. They get more cops out on the street. Well, what's going to happen? They're going to arrest more people because they're going to catch more crime. And then all of a sudden, the court system starts backing up. Well, what is the court system going to do? Typically, what it would do is it would start doing more work. They'd have more trials. And then they sentence more people to prison if need be. So now you've got more people going to prison. So now the prison systems get overloaded. So what do? They have to build more prisons. They have to get more guards. They have to hire more personnel. And then the cost of the whole system goes up. And then if corrections were just to release people early, what would happen? You'd have more of these individuals back out on the street. So that would start overloading law enforcement. So you can see how this cycle can happen. And so, like I said, it's a very fragile system. So what we're having right now is we're having an assault on every branch of this triangle. We've seen very publicly how they've gone after law enforcement very clearly, you know, defunding police. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to destabilize law enforcement. They're trying to get individuals, especially minorities, to not trust law enforcement. And then that causes more issues. So you have cops that retire early. They quit. I'm not going to go into law enforcement. Look what's going on in Portland. They can't even recover and hire enough people to get back the ones that have left because everybody's quitting. So you destabilize law enforcement. And look what's happening in the court system. Typically in the past, you've actually had DAs that even though they might be liberal or conservative, they've still enforced the law. So if somebody in law enforcement turns over a case to the DA's office, they would pursue that case to the maximum, you know, allowable by law. But now you see these very ultra-liberal DAs that are not doing that. They're handing out these, they're trying to get these minimal deals. And in some cases, they're just dropping the charges. What's interesting is when you're in law enforcement and you see a felony, you have to act upon that felony. You can't just say, you know what, I'm not gonna deal with that. With misdemeanors, there's a little more leeway depending on the type of crime. But felonies, you have to act on. You have to make an arrest or serve and release or whatever in the case. And you have to turn over that case to the DA's office. In a lot of states, they don't have that requirement. So what they can do is a DA can just decide, I'm going to drop charges. And we've seen this, Smollett up in Chicago. It was pretty obvious that she dropped the charges against him for personal reasons. It was not to do with enforcing the law, which is really what a district attorney should be doing. So we're seeing more and more of this activist type DAs that are getting elected in very liberal areas where in the past they would still enforce the law. They would still go through the court system and they would still get sentenced. So you see the assault right now on the court system. And another thing they're going to go after or have been in some places is the mandatory sentencing. They need to get rid of that. So you've heard about where in certain places they're trying to get rid of that, or they cut deals. So this whole assault on this triangle, I think, is to collapse the system. They're not looking to reform the system. In fact, when they first started talking about defunding police, and then when they started getting called out, they said, no, we just want to reform law enforcement. Nobody's talking about that right now. They're still talking about defunding, which is backfiring right in their face. Even the Seattle mayor had to recently say, okay, this ain't working. But what they're doing is you're seeing prisons and governors in some liberal states, they're doing early release. And they use COVID as an excuse to let people out of prison. And whenever I hear that term nonviolent, I'm just, okay, that bothers me because that's probably not true. You have DA's offices that are just dropping charges, just randomly. Everyone who was in the midst of a riot in New York City and other places, they're just dropping all the charges, or they're cutting deals that are very minimal. This whole $0 bail is extremely dangerous and going to get people hurt. No mandatory sentencing. They're trying to get rid of that, and they're destabilizing the police. But what is the goal? What is the goal of all this? It's to collapse the system. So right now, they're letting all these individuals or a lot of individuals out on the street that have no business being on the street. They need to be in prison or in jail, awaiting their day in court. So we have this problem right now, and you can see this every day in the news where they have all kinds of violence, and they're saying, well, you know, you shouldn't be blaming it to that on certain things. You know, it's a lot deeper, mental illness and all this other. The bottom line is one function of corrections is to protect us. We're the law-abiding citizens that aren't breaking the law. We need to be protected. And these are the same people who want to take our guns from us so we can't even protect ourselves. And then they're releasing all these people. And I just saw on the news, I think it was today or yesterday, where somebody committed this other crime, a heinous crime, and he'd been arrested 24, 25 times. I mean, how can you let someone back on the street that long? I mean, when they get arrested, they need to stay in jail until they go to trial. We need to make sure that we protect this system. Not only are they trying to go after the legislative branch and jack that all up with the federal government, I think there's an absolute assault on the judicial system, and they're trying to make it fail or collapse so they can change it themselves. and they can turn around and start doing maybe federal law enforcement and some other things, which can cause some serious problems. I personally feel, having been in law enforcement for many years, one of the backbones of our government is the local sheriffs. It's the local law enforcement. It's the local officials that we elect for our county commissioners and city councils and school board members. I think school board is very important when it talks about our community. So that was kind of the first thing I wanted to talk about, is the assault on our judicial system. At this point, I want to transition over and I'm going to switch back. I hate these backgrounds, but Thomas, if you could bring in John St. Augustine at this point, and if people want to ask a question or anything, you can always dial in. Again, the number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be monitoring. You'll see me look down and stuff. I will try to monitor for any questions, and we'll be more than happy to answer, because I have to tell you, I was pretty shook, and I actually found out about this when I was teaching. When the class asked me about this, they said, hey, you know, do you know what happened up in Aurora on July 23rd? The only thing that happened to me on July 23rd, it was my birthday. So that's how I can remember that date very well. They said, no, this event that happened when they're trying to arrest these three guys up in Aurora. And I said, well, I don't know anything about it. And they said, well, this officer pistol whipped the guy that he was trying to arrest. And I'm like, well, I have a hard time believing that, because nowhere in training is it to pistol whip anybody. So I had a real problem with that. And I told him, I said, look, you know, guys, let me review this. And then actually I'm teaching again tomorrow night to these recruits, and I'm sure we're going to have a pretty good conversation about this. But remember about John St. Augustine. So let me introduce him, and then I'll kind of give you a little feedback on myself. John St. Augustine is retired law enforcement with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, same as me, down here in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He was the commander of investigations, worked on numerous cases, homicide cases. He also was brought in because he was the commander, and before that, the inspector, which is the lead investigator in an organization. He was in charge of every investigation, to include officer-involved shootings and use of force issues. So John is an expert. He's also a defensive tactics instructor, or he was, right, John?
I mean, was.
Was back when he was with the sheriff's office. So he's very familiar with defensive tactics. Where I was not a defensive tactics instructor, but obviously I went through the training, and I also assisted on many of these investigations for officer-involved shootings and use of force issues. We're both court-qualified experts in police procedures and investigations. Since retiring from law enforcement about almost 8 years now, we have worked on numerous cases where we've come in and been asked to review these cases, and a lot of them have had use of force issues. So I've sat here and I've talked way too much, but I want to set the foundation for those on the podcast that are just listening. I'm not going to play the video. The video is so horrific anyway, but let me just kind of lay the whole thing out for you. What happens is you basically have it. I believe it's a church. I looked at the address. I looked it up. So a church called in and said, there's some people that are just kind of hanging out on our property. We'd like for you to send out some officers to get them off our property. So it was basically a trespass. Now, in this case, this would have been a second degree trespass. I'm also an expert in Colorado Revised Statute, so I know the law pretty well. This would have been a second degree trespass. They're just on their property. Actually, it wasn't even fenced in. It would have been third degree trespass, which is just a misdemeanor. So I'm assuming that the church was just wanting law enforcement to come out and just ask them, you know, hey, could you guys please move along? Now, the first thing you got to understand about working the street in uniform, I was a detective for the most of my career. Whenever you make contact with somebody, you need to know who you're talking to. You don't just, you know, pull someone over, make contact with someone, say, hey, I don't really care who you are, let's just talk. So probably one of the first things that they did is they asked them, who are you? Do you have some identification on you? Which they probably provided, or they told them who they were. Now, obviously, when you make contact with someone, you're going to find out who they are. Do they have any warrants? What's their background? If you're sitting there talking with Charles Manson, you probably want to know about it. So I'm assuming that that's what they did, is they got their information. They went back and they ran them, technical term, find out who they are and if there's any warrants. And all three of them came back with felony warrants. Now, at this point, law enforcement has zero options from the standpoint of, do they need to act upon this? They can't just go back to these guys and say, hey, you guys need to move along. They want you to leave and we'll see you later. These are felony warrants. They need to make an arrest. Now, when we talk about, and we'll talk a little bit, so I'm just going to keep going and then we're going to backtrack and talk about their procedures on how they did this. So what happened is there's three individuals. They're all kind of sitting down on a curb or an area here by this church. And one of the officers goes up and I can't tell if it's like, you know, you're all under arrest or whatever, but she's basically placing a guy into handcuffs. Well, as soon as that happens, you know, two guys stand up. The third individual, which is this Kyle Benson who gets assaulted, he's still just kind of sitting down and chilling out. The other two stand up. She starts to, you know, get out her handcuff and start the whole cuffing routine. And these two guys just bolt. They leave their bicycles. I think that you can see on the video, and I'm assuming a lot of people have seen the video. They bolt. The two Aurora cops, they don't do anything from the standpoint of there's no foot pursuit, which I would agree with. No reason to go running after them. You know, you can catch them another day. So obviously the third person who doesn't get up, he's kind of now the focus of the event, unfortunately. So they both kind of go over to him. And then this officer, Haubert, I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it. He basically puts his hand on this guy right from the beginning. He informs him that he has a warrant. And then you can see very quickly there's a gun out. And then long story short, they attempt to place him in custody to handcuff him. And it is pretty much policy to tell them to get on their stomach, you know, hands behind your back, over your head, you know, however you want to do it, and then place them in custody. Well, I will tell you from looking at the video, Mr. Vincent does resist arrest. I mean, it's very obvious that he does not want to go to jail. He does state very clearly, I don't have a warrant. That's a whole separate, you know, discussion. You don't, as law enforcement, say, oh, you don't have a warrant? Okay, my bad. It's not how it works. You're still going to place them in custody and you're going to confirm that there's a warrant. Things go bad very quickly. You see the officer basically start getting on top of them. And then there's some things that really are disturbing. You can see the gun play coming in where he's putting his gun on his head and saying things to him. And then at one point, he starts hitting him with the gun. Ultimately, he causes him a lot of injuries, none of which is called technical term, serious bodily injury, which would have made it first degree assault. But he basically hits him numerous times with the gun, pistol whipping, the term that we all know about. He also chokes him for a period of time and then ultimately gets him in custody after he's bleeding through his face and stuff. Gets him in a squad car and takes him to jail. So John, I'm talking way too much here. Is that kind of how the whole thing played out?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing I would tell you, you know, I don't know, Mark, for me, I think this was just an absolute disgrace to the profession. Your interpretation of him resisting, I'm not sure I quite kind of follow that Vincent was resisting. I think, you know, what we have to look at here is, you know, who's the person who's supposed to be in control? And when you look at an officer citizen interaction, right? Normally when law enforcement gets involved, either it's because you did something wrong or they're trying to ascertain like what went down, right? Like, you know, maybe there's a witness or maybe somebody, you know, happened to hear something. And so you got to remember when you wear that uniform, you know, you have to be that person that, you know, you're held at a much higher standard. So your interaction is always under a microscope. And the thing is even more so today with body cams, you know, police officers should know that, you know, you're being watched literally 24/7. And so when you interact with community, whether you know somebody has a warrant or they don't have a warrant, you still have to be respectful in the way that you interact with this individual or these individuals. And what I will tell you is, you know, when I had a chance last night and this morning to go over that video, it's extremely disturbing. There's really no justification whatsoever for either of those officers to escalate to the level that they did. You know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, one of the things that you would do when you first encounter somebody who potentially is involved in a crime is they obviously knew, if you said that they knew that there was warrants. I didn't know that. So I'm making an assumption here that there was something going on before the cameras actually were, these cameras are reviews that were given to us. Obviously something happened before this, and there must've been some interaction between these two officers and these three parties who were at this church, as you identified.
And so let's just say a parking lot, just so,
because to me, when I remember, I didn't see a church. I just saw a parking lot, and I saw three guys that were kind of hanging out and under a couple of trees on like a landscaped area. And so the idea here is that when law enforcement makes that initial contact, right, you're very cordial, you know, gentlemen, good afternoon. Obviously, we were called out to this location. I'd like to see your identification. You know, things like, could I please see your identification? You want this to be a situation where, you know, you're getting cooperation. You want to know who these people are, right? So at the point that they get their identification, they look at the ID, they look at the individual, the ID represents the person that they're talking to, right? They simply say, okay, guys, I just need you all to stand right here, sit down, get comfortable. And in the meantime, I'm just going to check on you guys. So what should happen at that point is when they check the ID and they run them for wants and warrants, right? At that point, what they should do is if there's something that is now flagged that these guys have potentially warrants, right? And again, the system is not always right. Sometimes there could be a warrant that should have been fixed and it's still showing as an active warrant. It could also say that there's not a warrant and there should have been one entered in the system. So from a law enforcement perspective, you got to be very, very careful about, you know, taking the information that you have and just jumping to a conclusion. And what I mean by that is elevating it to a point where now you're feeling like you have to use lethal force, right? You never, as a law enforcement officer, want to elevate it to lethal force unless there's lethal force that is being presented or that somebody else may potentially be hurt, right? A third party may be hurt. So when they knew that they, when these officers knew that there was a warrant, right? What should have happened, Mark, and you know it as well as I, you know, we've been there, is that you simply go, okay, we have three people who have active felony warrants. We have two police officers. Obviously, there's an outnumbering game here. There's three against two.
Like I always say, law enforcement is a team sport.
Right. And so what you do is you simply say, you know, when dispatch relays that these three parties are code five Frank, right, meaning that they're felony, right? Then what should have happened at that point is that either that officer should have asked for backup or dispatch would have already known from the fact that there was three active felony warrants that two officers there need some assistance, right? So they should have rolled additional resources to that particular site. Instead, what happens, right, is that these officers immediately encounter them. Now, we can debate about whether this has something to do politically, about whether it's because of defunding police or whatever. I'm here to tell you that plan by them encountering them right away was obviously, in hindsight, not a good plan because two ran away, right? And as you know, if two run away, one's not going to go chase the other two, and the other one's not going to sit there and be alone when you have potentially all three parties with active felony warrants, which is why you bring officers to that location so that now you outnumber the parties that have the felony warrants.
So let's talk a little more about the initial, because we don't get to see the initial contact.
Right.
I have to assume, based on my experience, during an initial contact, you're going to make sure they don't have any weapons. You're going to tell them very clearly, hey, for my safety and stuff, don't put your hands in your pockets. You're probably going to just pat them down just to make, you know, you're going to explain it to them. I'm doing this to make sure we don't have any weapons. Have a seat. You know, you see that they're all three seated down. That didn't write. Sit down or sitting down.
Right.
And then you know at that point that they don't have any weapons. And this is the thing that gets me. It seems like they go straight to hands-on. That, you know, again, I wouldn't have gone 2-on-3. We can talk about the tactics and stuff, which I think was completely wrong. But going past that, when the two take off, when they book and take off, bolt, you've got a 2-on-1, which is a much better situation. You can catch the other two on another day. And I agree with you 100%. There should have been other officers there before they said, oh, by the way, you guys all have warrants. And I would have only told one at a time. I would have told the other two, hey, you guys are good to go. Just sit there and chill. But this guy has a warrant. And then deal with the one. Then go back and say, oh, by the way, you do too. But once they get down to just Mr. Benson, it's just him. Mm-hmm. And you made this statement, and I think we agree, but I just didn't say it right, about him resisting. Mm-hmm. At first, you can very clearly see in the video where he's like in a completely defensive posture. And I'm talking about Mr. Benson. Right. He's on the ground, on his back, and he's just like, hey, you know, and he actually says, you know, don't shoot me, because he has the gun out. So I would question, why is that gun out? And sometimes having a gun out is a problem. And this is the reason why. If I've got a gun in one hand, I can only deal with you with one hand, because I got this, I can't do anything with the gun other than pistol whip you, which he does a little bit later on, which is completely unjustified. At that point, if he knew that he didn't have any weapons, there was a bag there, you could have pushed the bag out of the way, holster your weapon, and you have so many other tools available. And again, even before that point, the most powerful tool that law enforcement has is their verbal skills.
That's right.
Is the ability to de-escalate, which is, they teach you so much in training about de-escalation. And how much de-escalation was there in this case? Zero. At no point does he say, hey, just relax. We'll figure this out, okay? If you don't think you have a warrant, we'll figure it out. You know, in fact, let me take a step back here. You just sit there for a minute. Okay, let me tell you, you have an active warrant, okay? And so there's procedures that we have to do. So let me explain the whole process to you. If they'd have sat there and explained it, he wasn't running. He made no aggressive maneuver or anything towards either one of the officers to justify that type of hands-on scenario. And they're the ones who are escalating. Great. It's not that he escalated. I think a lot of that, when I say resisting, he's trying to not give him his hands and stuff. He's in complete defensive mode because they've kind of got him backed in a corner, so to speak. And I think he's reacting to their actions.
Well, and going back, Mark, I mean, as you said, right? I mean, we used to joke when we come up on somebody and go, hey, you don't have a bazooka in your pocket or needles that are going to stick me. Right. And you're just creating some rapport with that individual. So if they made that initial contact and they knew that that person doesn't have any weapons, right? They patted him down. Right. There's no weapons. So at that point that he's on the ground, okay, the only thing that I saw that could potentially be of any kind of harm to the officers is if there was something in that backpack, right? There was like a black bag, I believe, that was off to his left as he was sitting down. But what I will tell you is that, you know, you're telling him to turn around and be on his face, and he's on his face with his head into the ground, and he's actually saying, I can't breathe. And right. So what we have to be aware of is if he took his hands and he stuck them somewhere inward to where now he's providing himself a little bit of a breathable area. Right. Because remember, his face is down in the dirt. He's not able to breathe very well. The only way that he can either do that is to turn his face in one direction or potentially have his hands out, right, to where he can keep it up and actually breathe. What we don't know, right, is, again, if you know that he doesn't have any weapons on him, why, number one, why did you pull that gun out right when he's sitting there and he's being compliant? I mean, he is literally he's not being resistant. He's being compliant. It's like, whoa, 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 what's going on? What's going on here? Right. And what becomes even more troubling is that as you see the video continue, you know, he's like, I don't have a warrant. I don't have a warrant. And I know we've had this discussion in the past. Just because a potential suspect tells you something doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
They do. But
but at this point, he hasn't given you a reason to not believe him, because guess what? He's the one guy that did not run. Right.
Right.
So
right.
Unless we're
he
dealing
does
with
think guy, he doesn't have a warrant.
Yeah. Unless this guy has an active warrant for murder, like you said, or he has some active warrant, like he, you know, raped a bunch of, you know, kids and he's been on the run for so long, then you would have handled the situation completely different. Right. You would have probably
his actual warrant. And of course, and I'm going by what's kind of out in the been released to the media. It was a probation violation.
Yeah.
So, and they would have known that. And of course, it would be a felony warrant because of the probation and how it works in the system. But again, he's not kicking and, you know, he's not actively attacking them.
Right.
You know, so, he, I mean, really, the officers could have taken a step back. He could have holstered his weapon. He could have decided for an alternate plan, like maybe pepper spray or tape. And I don't even think that would have been justified. Mm-hmm. If they just would have backed off and just said, okay, wait a minute, maybe we got off on the wrong foot here. Right. Okay, let me verify the warrant and stuff, but let me explain the process.
Right.
I'm required to place you in handcuffs. And as soon as we verify that that warrant is not current or active, or we have the wrong person, I will personally take those handcuffs off of you.
Right.
And again, I really think Mr. Vinson was reacting to the escalation that the officer created.
Absolutely.
He never did anything to de-escalate anything. And that's when I say resistance, and maybe that resisting, that maybe that is a little too strong, because I think he's reacting to what their escalation.
Right. In law enforcement, right, they have a thing called ability, opportunity, and jeopardy. He created that jeopardy, Mark. What happened,
right,
is that officer, by drawing his weapon immediately, this, how was that guy? I mean, you know, if you're, don't shoot me, don't shoot me. I mean, I can't breathe. Don't shoot me, don't shoot me. I mean, that was his immediate reaction as his gun's being pummeled into his head. And so,
right, and then he does, puts the gun into his head.
Right.
I mean,
as he's on the ground,
as he's dead.
Exactly.
I don't think I've ever done that ever. And then said, if you don't move or I'll shoot you.
Right.
I mean, that is felony menacing. That is the definition of felony menacing, because he's not justified in what he's doing. They literally, it's so interesting. He could have just stepped up and stepped back. I don't think the guy would have ran from him and just said, you know what, let's start over again.
Well, and here's the thing.
He constantly escalates.
Exactly. And the thing is, because he didn't run, the best thing he could, thank you for not running. Look, we've got to clean up some things here, because obviously there's some things here that we need to talk to you about. But in the meantime, I need you just to sit down. Okay. I need you to listen to what I'm telling you and just be very respectful. There's no
there never reason. Was a conversation.
There was never one.
I never saw a conversation of, hey, you know, just to let you know, you have a warrant, just sit there, you know, and we're going to work this out. It was straight to hands on, get over on your stomach, you know, no conversation. And you know, another one question that I have is, what's the hurry?
Exactly.
Was there some time limit? Was there some buzzer that was going to go off in 30 seconds? You know, kind of like when you're hog tying somebody at a rodeo, you're trying to get the quickest time or something. Right. I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me as to why he was constantly escalating the whole situation. And it's almost like he wanted this. And we definitely know from my research where they've talked about the fact that he actually was charged with menacing before, because he pointed a shotgun at his roommate a few years before. I mean, a few years
back
before.
Yeah, back in like 2008, 2009. Yeah.
Yeah, way back when. And then they plea bargained it down to
prohibited use.
Prohibited use of a weapon, which means that you had alcohol in your system when you had a weapon on you. So we already know there's some anger management issues, you know, so, and I have to tell you, I'm just so shocked. You know, at first when my students told me to go look at this video, I was like, yeah, I'll go check it out. You know, we'll see. There's two sides to every story. Well, there's not two sides to this story. I mean, I was appalled from beginning to end, from the tactics at the beginning all the way to the end. When I saw those welts on this guy's head,
oh, I know,
after he just beat him, you know, pistol whipping. And again, I don't know if we made this crystal clear. Nowhere in training, I mean, we've both been through law enforcement training. You went through a lot more in defensive tactics. At what point do you teach people or law enforcement to pistol whip anyone?
The only time you would even use your weapon, your handgun, in a manner that was used in this particular deal is if you are in a life or death situation, your gun has malfunctioned and you no longer have the ability to fire that weapon, you may use the one end just to try and stop whatever is happening so that you don't die or you don't suffer from serious bodily injury. But it's not a tactic.
But he's not being attacked.
No, he's not.
He is the aggressor.
That's
it. This whole process.
Right.
And that's just, and I have to tell you, it's just so appalling to me. You know, here I've been talking about all this pro-law enforcement stuff, you know, with Chuck and Julie and all this going backwards, you know, up to now about, how law enforcement's not like this. You know, right. If you cooperate, if you don't resist, if you're cooperative, you're not going to get beat up by the police. And look what happens.
Right. You know, you have a situation. And Mark, sorry to interrupt you, but the one thing I picked up on, which was interesting in the video, is that when he's sitting there and he's got his gun out and he's pummeling this poor kid with his weapon, at the moment that the other officers come as backup, I don't know if you noticed, but he quickly puts that weapon into his holster. And guess what the officers that come on scene do? The officers that come on scene, they actually bring out a taser.
Right. What a great
tool.
They
bring out a less than
lethal.
Less than lethal, right? And guess what? They got him to comply right away. So the question is, why didn't the other officer, I think her name was Francine Martinez.
Yes.
So the other officer, you know, why didn't she deploy her taser if she felt that, you know, because again, right, why are we elevating to lethal force when there hasn't, you know, nobody yelled gun, nobody yelled knife, nobody said anything like he has something
there's no weapon that anybody knows of.
Right. There is no, and the video is the proof, right? At no point does anybody yell gun. At no point does anybody yell any kind of weapon. He wasn't swinging a bat. He wasn't swinging his backpack in a way that could create injury. He's not swinging anything. He's like, right. whoa. He's on the ground. That's where you want him. You want him on the ground.
Right.
And he's complying. So then he turns around and he puts his head in the ground and you shove a gun into the back of his head. I mean,
and you escalate the situation. I mean, you completely escalate it. I mean, and it's just such a bad show for law enforcement. But here's kind of one of the key points is the system's working.
It's not.
I mean, it didn't work back when this Yahoo got hired. He never should have got into law enforcement. And yes, he did. He just resigned a couple of days ago. Someone just asked if he quit. Yes, he did quit. I don't think he was ever previously in law enforcement, but he had that event. He never should have got into law enforcement. But the system now, because the chief, I believe, even admitted, I didn't know about this prior event, you know, before he was hired. But the system is working now from the standpoint of you're going to find almost everybody. Well, you're going to find everybody in law enforcement that's just going to say, oh, my goodness, this video is going to cause so much harm for law enforcement because we're trying to explain to people, look, don't believe this race, you know, systemic racism. Don't believe all this craziness. If you don't resist, you're not going to get hurt. And then this comes out.
Well, and it's here's a problem. And again, I'm interrupting you and I apologize.
Yeah, go ahead.
But, you know, the thing that we have to look at with Aurora, and I've worked with Aurora PD during
great organization.
They are. And unfortunately, there's been three recent events that have really put a black eye on Aurora PD. You got the Elijah McClain situation, right? You've got that situation where they proned out a bunch of Black African-American women and their kids out on a pavement. And now you've got this situation. They're, you know, something, and I know they've got a new chief there, Vanessa, I can't remember. It's Wilson, Chief Wilson, I believe it is. They've got a new, you know, new chief, and I think they're trying to change the culture of what has been going on. I don't know if it's a cultural thing, if it's just these officers that happen to be the bad apples that have a microscope on them, but you're right. There's something awfully wrong with the way that things are being handled. And, you know, whether you want to say it's racism or not, unfortunately, Elijah McClain was African-American. The vehicle stopped. They were all African-American. This kid, Kyle Vinson, is African-American. And so, you know, obviously, right, the media is going to have a heyday with this. And the reality is that, you know, this is bad. It's a black eye. It has tarnished the profession.
But what you have to also put out there, just to make sure that everybody understands, there's millions of law enforcement contacts every year. Millions.
Yes.
There's millions with African-Americans, with Hispanics, with whites.
Yep.
There's contacts all the time. You still have a better chance of getting hit by lightning than you do to get hurt from law enforcement if you don't resist.
Yeah, but the problem, Mark, that I have with this is that there's no way we can look at this video and say that there's anything good that came from it. The only good that can come from this is if they make changes to it. And there has to be change because the fact that this guy, this is bad. I don't care what anybody says.
Well,
this
from
is,
beginning to end, I mean, if you really want to look at it from, if you brought in experts to look at this whole thing from beginning to end, their tactics from the beginning are completely bad. Like you had talked about rapport. Rapport is so important in law enforcement. I used to joke with people all the time. Like you were saying, you want to get their IDs so you can, so you know who they are, so you can run them for wants and warrants. I used to tell them, I said, hey, guys, you know, they want to know who I'm talking to make sure I'm still working and not just, you know, hanging out at 7-Eleven. So do you mind giving me your ID so I can tell them who I'm talking to so they know that I'm still working? Will you help me out here a little bit? So I start joking with these people. And the whole time I'm still doing my officer safety to make sure that everything's safe, but I'm getting them relaxed. And then if I had to come back, I would tell you, and I think you would agree with me, if I have to arrest three people for felony warrants and there's only two of us and there's other officers out there, it's one thing if there's nobody else, but I'd have gotten more people out there. So the bottom line is it's all about tactics. And I want to briefly here tell you about an example that I have. When I was in investigations, I was going out looking for a witness in a case. I can't even remember the case, but I went to somebody's house to try to find somebody to do this interview with a witness in a case. So I go in to this house, me and another detective, and I do that game right where I just said, I said, hey, do you guys mind giving me some IDs so I can tell them that I'm actually talking with people so they know that we're just not out boondoggling? So they give me their IDs. The father of this house had a warrant. So I knew that I had to arrest the father of this household. I have no choice. You know, once I know that he has a warrant, I have to make an arrest. So what I did in that situation is I asked the dad, hey, would you mind talking to me privately outside? So we went outside and I said, look, here's the deal. You know, you got a warrant. You know, you're out on probation. Actually, I think it's the same scenario. It's a violation of probation. I said, look, I don't want to arrest you right here in front of your family. Do you have any problems? You can't go back in the house, you know, for my safety. Just telling them that you're coming with us to help us and talk to us. And then you can explain it to him later. And he goes, dude, I really appreciate that. So we walked out to the cruiser unmarked and we placed him in custody there and put him in the car and we drove him to the jail. And he told me on the way to jail, he said, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that you did not put me in handcuffs in front of my family. He goes, I would have probably fought about anybody, but because you were so square with me, I wasn't going to fight. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I always thought about you treat people with decency no matter who they are until they give you a reason not to. That's right. And this video is going to do so much harm for law enforcement that what's going to happen is you're going to have other contacts, especially in Aurora, in the Denver area, and you're going to have a minority getting pulled over by a police car. And they're going to start making poor decisions based on these rare exceptions where these people make these horrific, like you said, there's no other side to the story. There is no good side to this entire video. It's all bad.
Right. I agree. And, you know, now the question is, you know, I know that the other officer, Francine Martinez, I think was her name.
Yes.
Now she's, you know, being scrutinized for, you know, why didn't she step up? And, you know, anybody who's been in the profession, when you're an outsider looking in, it's easy to say that. But the last thing, you know, and I'm not justifying the fact that she didn't report this by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm just saying that the fact that she didn't report this is concerning, but I also can see her, you know, being apprehensive in wanting to be that whistleblower because we've all been in this profession, you and I, right? Where you know those individuals that kind of, you know what, it's always, you know, this way or that way. And they always complain about if it's not exactly to the letter of the law, right? By the book. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. There's a very gray area in what we do, right? It's not always truly black and white. There's a very gray area. You know, life is very gray. But what's going to happen now is that she's going to be lumped in with Hubbard, this officer. And right. It's unfair. Should she be disciplined? Absolutely. And I think she should obviously be, they're going to set an example of her saying that, look, if you see something like this, right, then you need to report it. But what's also troubling, Mark, when I looked at this, what about all the other officers? Did all the other officers that showed up, did they report it? Or was it only because it was her who was with him at the time that he's, you know, beating the crap out of him with his gun? Because if the other officers saw Vincent the way that we saw that on that video, they should have all been asking a lot of questions like, how did he get these injuries? Like, what just happened? And if they knew that that came from either Hubbard or from Martinez, they are also mandated to also report. Right.
Well, they should have at least asked the question. I could see if you show up, you're like, what did he do to justify that kind of beat down? If it's like, well, he didn't do anything. What, you know, where's the knife? You know, where's this right. weapon that you're defending yourself from? Then they should have asked the questions and they should have said, I have an issue based on the lack of information I have because I showed up late.
Right.
I mean, I've never seen an individual with those kind of wounds with an encounter with law enforcement, unless they were actively fighting, you know, I've just never seen it. Right. So
here's what I was getting at is that I will be shocked if during the course of this internal affairs investigation and this criminal investigation into what happened to Vincent, that there's not additional parties that potentially will have some kind of disciplinary action against them.
Well,
right?
We don't know the whole story.
We don't know the whole story. Yeah. We don't.
But, you know, definitely letters of reprimand or whatever. I would like to hope or like to think that if I showed up as another officer on scene and I saw somebody in that situation, that I would have been asking those questions. And that's what really needs to come from this. You know, again, the system is working. This individual has already quit. They've already said, and this is a thing I really like, is that we're going to continue the investigation.
Right.
You know, we're not going to shut down. That's what happens so many times is an officer will resign. They'll stop the IA investigation, the internal affairs investigation. Right. And then he goes and gets hired someplace else, goes to another state or whatever. So in this case, we're going to continue this on. Pretty sure he's going to end up where he's going to lose his post certification, so he can't be a cop anywhere.
As he should.
So the system's working. So hopefully there's going to be some follow up from this. And to kind of wrap things up, John, the good news is we found it disturbing.
Yes.
You know, individuals that have been in law enforcement for a long time watch this video. Like you said, there's no good part to this video. I don't like any part of this video at all. This is not how I did law enforcement, and this isn't how everybody that I worked with did law enforcement. And I wouldn't even say they're going to make an example out of him because he's not an example. This is how the system should work.
Right.
You know, he's,
I mean,
he's
I'll, not, give, I'll give kudos to the chief. I mean, the fact that she released that body cam, kudos to her, because, you know, there are a lot of agencies that would have held off on even releasing that. And, you know, my understanding is that the mayor apparently said alleged allegations against this individual. I don't know what you can allege at this point. The video is pretty clear that he did what he did. So, right. You know, I hope the mayor of Aurora, has the courage to come out and just say what's wrong is wrong. And what's wrong is what we saw. Absolutely wrong.
Right. And it is wrong. And I hope the system works, which it is already at this point. And hopefully if John and I get to do this again, just to wrap this up real quick, I think we've only got about 30 seconds. We're not going to harp on this kind of stuff because, to be honest with you, I mean, this is just wrong and there's no justification to really explain it. What you saw is what you get. It's wrong. We'll talk about cases and stuff that we've worked on and stuff. So if we do this again some more in the fall, hopefully we'll do that. And we can talk about all kinds of stuff. I love Chuck and Julie's show, watching. Occasionally you'll see me jump on there and stuff because they do such a great job and I love everything that they do. John, again, thank you for helping me out with this.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Have a great week. And everybody else, I hope you have a great week. Talk to you later.